We're starting tonight with the Maharam of Rothenburg. The Maharam of Rothenburg lived from 1215 to 1293. He was from the Rhine area. He learnt in the yeshivas of Paris and Evreux, which I spoke about other weeks. As we saw, I think it was last week. Yeah, it was last week. That in 1242, the French government burnt Shas, burnt the Talmud, and forbade learning did not allow Jews to hold on to Gemaras. The French government. 1242. I think this is called late medieval. It's not even called or middle medieval. It's certainly not even early modern. Government really couldn't enforce such a law strictly. On the other hand, I think it's also quite obvious that if it's technically illegal to have Gemaras, you can't really operate a yeshiva well in such an atmosphere. So more or less, the yeshivas which had existed in northern France, Paris, Evreux, and a couple of other places, dwindled and closed down.
Was this before Rashi or after Rashi?
It was well after Rashi.
Well
after Rashi. Rashi died almost 150 years before this.
1040 or
he was born 1040? He was born 1040. Okay. So, the gravity center of Torah and Ashkenaz shifted back to Eastern France, Western Germany, because Eastern France, France's border at the time, was significantly farther west than it is today. The whole Rhine area, Alsace-Lorraine, was not really French. It was technically part of the Holy Roman Empire. And that's where the Maharam was from. And he was able to open a yeshiva. It's apparent that he moved around a little bit, but the place he was in the longest was Rothenburg, which probably means Red Mountain. That's what it probably means. Yeah. No, it's fine. It's fine. I just have congestion on my chest. That's all. Maybe if I'm lucky, I'll be able to cough some of it out. Okay.
Is this going okay?
Say again?
Is this going okay?
This is recorded. Yes, it's recorded, David. Yeah, what can I tell you?
Feldman's fault.
No, it's not Feldman's fault. Okay. Now, there's a... let's just see. Wait a second. The most famous thing about the Maharam from Rothenburg is that he tried to run away. He tried to run away from Germany. He was definitely having some problems with the emperor. The emperor was the ruler of Germany at the time. That's what the German emperor, that's what the ruler of the Holy Roman Empire was called, the emperor. He was caught and held to a massive ransom of 30,000 marks. They asked a ransom of 30,000 marks for the Maharam.
Now,
say again. No, I actually can't. You know what? I think that's a good question. What was that in modern day numbers? It's considered highly excessive. So I would say we're talking about in modern numbers millions. That's a very hard question. How to relate to things in modern numbers, if you understand more deeply.
Millions of what?
Dollars.
Okay. For
he was held as what? Yeah,
what was the actual number then?
30,000 marks.
Why did he do in Germany?
Say again?
If he was in Germany, why did the French burning the Talmud
have anything? No, okay. Why is the French burning the Talmud is why the central gravity of Torah learning shifted back to Germany. Got that?
So why did Maron want to leave Germany?
Because the Germans started making problems also. Germany, as I guess we're not aware, I guess I'm all aware of this, Germany at this point in time was divided into a lot of small...
Right, it was Bavaria.
Yeah, wait a second. Small little states. They weren't really all independent. Technically, it was all ruled.
City-states.
There were some city-states, but there were also a lot of principalities and all sorts of different types of, little sub-particles, etc. I forget the exact number of components of the German states. The official ruler was the emperor. It's more complicated. I mean, I'm sure we're all familiar with Voltaire's famous line.
It's not holy, it's not Rome, it's not empire.
Thank you. I said everyone's familiar with that one. That's not really as true, of course, as... I mean, not holy, okay, that Voltaire was right about. But, okay. Not Roman, he's not really... I mean, he's sort of right, but he's sort of wrong that the legal language was Latin. The legal language in the Holy Roman Empire was Latin. So that's key to what was Roman about it. Empire, again, it wasn't... Whatever, it wasn't that much worse than France... Before 1200 or so. So it's like, it's true that it never really developed into a modern centralized state. That's true, but okay, whatever. That's for complicated reasons and not now. This has nothing to do with Jewish history. Okay, yeah. So for whatever the reasons, the Maharam had to run away from Germany because of conflict with the authorities. He was captured, and a 30,000 mark ransom was asked. I'm not sure what that number is. I mean, I don't know. There are ways. If I had a lot of time, the true question is how accurate Wikipedia would be on this. That's real. No, because you don't know. In other words, for example, I believe the English government gave a 20,000 pound reward for discovering longitude. Accurate measurement of longitude.
I was going to say, they kind of just made it up. It's not like...
No. That's definitely... I can more or less estimate what that is.
Like, this letter here is...
Yeah. But English currency, hey, whatever. It was a significant sum. We're talking about a very significant sum. I mean, you understand that this is in the 1200s. This is around 1270 or so. It's around 1270. And in England, hundreds of years later, which means in the 1600s, £100 was considered making a lot of nice, that was considered a nice middle class income was £100 a year. Okay, now it's true that the pound to mark, let's say, was at least 6 to 1, but the point is if 600 marks 400 years later are considered a nice income, then... the equivalent of, let's say, $25,000, $30,000 today in terms of buying power, then you're talking about a lot of money. We're talking about a lot of money. Okay. Fine. He was held for 30,000 marks. And the Maharam had paskened. The Maharam had previously paskened that ransom is really a person's own responsibility. And if they have the ability to repay ransom, they are obligated to. It's true, but the person also has a personal obligation to repay if they're able to, because you had a traditional problem. You had rich people who knew how to hide their money, and they would be caught, captured for ransom, and they try to throw it onto the tzibur, onto the public coffer, and that's not right. And these are sugyas. It's not just an issue of moral stand. There are also sugyas involved. And the Maharam wasn't just saying svaras, he was coming from sugyas. He also paskened that previous to his imprisonment, that if they ask for exorbitant ransom, that it should not be given. And then he was held for it. And the Maharam, as they say, proved his mettle, as Rashi says, I think it's a Radak, maybe not Rashi, on the Pasuk in Tehillim Kuf Yud Tes. Yeah, I'll find it. Yeah, there you go. You're saying I'm not going to do anything without a Tanakh. Is that what you're trying to say? It's in Peis. I think it's in Peis. B'me yizaka naras orcha lishmar kidvarecha. How does a person make his path clear, make himself meritorious in his path? He guards your words. So the Radak says it doesn't mean he guards Torah. It means if you have a chiddush in Torah, you have to keep it. It's a personal obligation to keep it. I'll give you two examples. Here we have one example, a historical example of the Maram of Rotenberg. He held that if you're held for Pidyon Shvuyim, if you're captured and they ask a ransom that is well beyond anyone's means and is unreasonable, it should not be paid. And therefore, he stayed in prison for 14 years.
That's a really long time. Did he have like Gemaras?
He had a limited amount of... He had a head, that's true, but it wasn't prison. That got complicated. Yes, he had access to Svarim. I'm not sure exactly how much. He had limited access. One of his Talmidim had a Reb Shit, who's called the Tashbatz, was the only person. The early, there's two Tashbatz. There's Sephardi Tashbatz is later, and this is the Ashkenaz Tashbatz, who's earlier.
Is Tashbatz the same, or just pronounced differently?
It's just different pronunciations, it's the same thing.
Like the guy in the Mishnah Berurah quotes.
The one who Mishnah Berurah quotes is probably usually the Ashkenazi Tashbatz, but it might be sometimes there's also a Sephardi called Tashbatz, who's a little later. Okay. So I'll give you two other historical examples. Say again?
You're saying his student,
the Tashbatz, was allowed to come into him and he brought questions into him and he recorded those answers in Shilas and Shuvas Tashbatz. Okay. Fascinating. Yeah. Okay. Yes, we do. Now, two other quick historical examples. Hopefully it won't take too long. One is the Tanzer Rebbe. Tanzeruv.
Look at me.
Yeah, don't look at you. You've heard of Kiryat Sanz and Netanya?
Yeah, I know Sanz.
Yes, Kiryat Sanz. His father, not the present one. His father, the Sanz held, the great-grandfather, the Divri Chaim, held the machine matzahs or chametz. Wait a second. That's okay, whatever. That's a lot of people post come chaluk on him. It's fine. A lot of mitzvahs, there's some mitzvahs yudavki machine matzahs.
Why are they chametz?
Whatever, because he's talking about old machines. They couldn't really clean the machine properly, etc., etc., etc. Okay, the Lariato Hospital in Netanya, which is founded by the Tzanzer Ruv, because he was once when he was in either in Auschwitz or one of the camps, he was very sick and he had no way to get better. And to go to the hospital meant you'd bought it, dear. Oh, definitely dead. There's nothing to talk about. It was not whatever. So he made a neder that if Hashem cures him. After the war is over, he'll go to Eretz Yisrael and found a hospital. So eventually he did. Eventually he made it here and founded the Kiryat Sanz and eventually founded the hospital. So
that's where my app works.
Okay. Now, in the Kiryat Sanz hospital on Pesach, in Kiryat Sanz hospital, in Laniata hospital, they serve all patients head shmura matzah. Why? Because that's the Tzanzer Rav's psak. And that's B'mei Yizak and that other Rabbanim Rechon, B'vakasha. That if you hold of something, you have to do it. And I say, Rav Hershel Shechter does the same thing. He holds that milk cows in America are treifas. He knows everyone's argues with him, but he holds they're treifas. And as his son told me, he says, I asked him, what does your father say about eating, drinking milk? He says, you might as well drink chaser, eat chaser. So that's B'mei Yizak and Nara Zarcho, Dishmak and Varecho. If you hold on something, you could know that other people arguing with you are competent Rabbanim. But if you hold that's the halacha, you have to keep it. So one of the first clear examples I know of is here with the Maharam. Okay, he died in prison, and the emperor was upset that he lost his 30,000 marks. So he refused to release his body. Held for another 14 years. His body was held for another 14 years until he was finally someone someone who is quite well to do personally redeemed the body with his own money.
Why they keep dead bodies?
It's not the only time. It was historically done. This was not the only time it was done.
Just to get more money. To get the money for someone.
Yeah, that's right.
Because they made someone important.
They were hoping someone would not buy it, would redeem it. And that's eventually what happened. Someone did it out of his own pocket, which makes it probably, let's see the dates. Interesting who paskened that question. It's after the rush, it was no longer in Germany. So it's a good question who paskened that was what you had to do. But nonetheless, that's what happened. Okay, on to the Rajma. The Rajma, 1235 to 1310. From Barcelona, Talmud of the Ramban and Rabbeinu Yonah. He's a Talmud of the Ramban and Rabbeinu Yonah. When we say Stam Rajba today, we will say Rajba without anything else. We mean this Rajba. Even though there are two other people who have been mentioned earlier who could be called Rajba, Stam Rajba, a Rajba without any other comment, is this Rajba. He's actually, again, the last Rajba, but 1235 to 1310. Now, if you learned Baba Basha last year well, and you paid attention to Chidushi HaRajma, even though there are people who aren't sure who he learned by more, the Ramban or Rabbeinu Yonah, one could see that he quotes Rabbeinu Yonah as Mori HaRav, as my master and teacher, and in the Ramban he just quotes either, you know, the quotes by name or Mori or Mori HaRamban. He doesn't call him Mori HaRav. Stam, you know, my Stam Rebbe. So it is quite demonstrable from the Chidush HaRajma to Baba Basra that his primary teacher was Rabbeinu Yonah.
At least that time.
What?
At least at that time.
Yeah, okay. You know, it's not. Okay, whatever. That's interesting. You know, Eitan, you're asking a good and legitimate question, and I have to think more before I try to answer you. Okay, now, if you keep learning up Shas with Rishonim, then it's definitely clear that the Ramban, in terms of content, and this is true in Baba Basra also for the records, in terms of content, the Rajba follows the Ramban much more than Rabbeinu Yonah. That's clear in terms of content. So that would, whatever. So he's really like another important step in, you know, combining Ashkenazi and Sephardi Torah. We'll get another. Now, I think it's whoever has learned something seriously.
Wait, but they're all Ashkenazim?
No, the Rajma's totally Sephardi.
Really?
Totally Sephardi.
Really?
We'll get there. Come on. I'm going to talk about that, not this week, next week. I talked about that earlier. And Rishonim are Rishonim, by and large. And we don't really... I wouldn't say there's no connection between what happened then and what's going on now, but there's not that clear of a connection.
In terms of halacha, though.
In terms of halacha, we'll go when we get... It's going to take about 3-4 weeks... Again, anyone who really learns this in a serious, learns Rajba, Ramban, Rajba, Ritva, in a serious fashion, Tosus, Ramban, Rajba, and Ritva, knows that no one is copying anyone else in a rote, you know, mechanical fashion. By definition, you know, as it's said, Ein Beis Midrash Bo Chiddush. Do you know what that means? I should translate that into English. I'll translate that. Anyone got that one? What? There's no base. Well, what does that mean? There's no base. That means when a person learns sugya properly, by force they have chidushim. There's no way to engage in proper Torah learning and not come up with some new, maybe even very slightly new, but some new nuance. I know, for example, people who've gone to Reb Asher Ayeli's shir for years. That's not enough to spit out. We'll tell you that he doesn't quite say the same thing every time. I mean, and the whole, he comes to the same conclusions, but he doesn't just say the same thing over each time.
Is that, wait, who's
That's a contemporary statement about Reb Asher Arieli.
Well, who said
is a statement of Chazal. To show you how many places or where that occurs, I would take a little time. We could probably do it with a search machine, but that's a well-known rule. Okay, so again, even though he's following the Ramban, it's a mistake to think that the Rashi and the Ramban always agree. He could make a number of what would superficially appear to be minor emendations and changes. But after you learn it, Biyun, you see that they're saying quite different things. So that's just, I mean, it's not always true. It's not always true. Okay. Now, something else, there's two other things the Rashi was important for. One is, he's the finale, at least in the Tekufas, in the times of Rishonim, of the anti-Rambam problems. There was another outburst of anti-Rambam agitation in the Rashba's times. This time it was, the last time we saw it was led by the Rashba bin Ahar, Rabbi Shlomo bin Ahar, and Rabbeinu Yonah, who without any question are major players. They are, you know, they're big leaguers. This time it was led by someone who is not nearly as significant. His name is Rabbi Shlomo Petit. We don't really know that much about him. He's definitely not included in this period of time as one of the great Rishonim. I'm not saying he's completely, completely
what
nothing.
What are the years?
This is in the 1260s, 1270s.
Yeah, what were they leaving? Sorry.
Was Hagen?
Anti-Rambam.
I spoke about that at length. And Kanal, you want to listen to the Shurim B'Vakasha? I did good research into it, and they're good Shurim. Okay, so the over here it was not nearly as serious. Again, Rishon Petit, it's sort of like the opponents of the Rambam in his life. They're mainly known for, that's what they're really mainly known for. They're not like big major figures who are known. No, I said this time. The last time it was a serious issue. This time it wasn't really a serious issue. And the Rashba defines what's called the standard norm for what to do with the Rambam for 500 years or so. Which is, the Rambam's great, but the philosophical parts should only be learned after you have a good base in the rest of the Torah. And that was... That is, not Shemana Prakim you could learn. That is. The Hakdamas are fine, the Igras are fine. More Nevuchim should be waited until a person is more based in the rest of the Torah. Now we have other issues. I can discuss that. I would tell you, I'll discuss it with you later tonight. Mishmor, but I'm not staying for Mishmor, as I told you already. So we can discuss that, Be'ezer Hashem, next week.
If you want.
I can't. I'm actually not feeling so 100%, as you can hear. And we're making a Kiddush on Shabbos, and I just can't. Okay, now the other very important thing of the Rashba is the Rashba has the most extensive Shailos and Tshuvos responsa, the most extensive Shailos and Tshuvos of any Rishon, and more extensive than most Achronim. Standardly, the Rambam has the Rashba has seven volumes of Shailos and Tshuvos, which is extensive. Now, this is very important for two reasons. One reason is just the material itself, regardless of what it's talking about. Just that amount of output from any one Rishon is like unbelievable.
How do they have time to write all this stuff down?
That's a good question. That's a good question. I'm not sure.
That's
a good question. I'm not sure. The other thing, of course, is the other important issue is when something's explicit in Shas or in Poskim, then it's not so hard to know what to do. But Shas and Shuvas, by and large, are new cases which come up, which are not explicit, and that's why the Rashba, Shas and Shuvas are very important. Okay, now, say again?
Do we still use them?
Like, we definitely still use them.
How many new cases did they have in the 12?
That's an interesting question. I'm not sure, but the Rashba has seven volumes of Shailos and Tshuvos, extensive. Thousands. We possess, I would say, at least 2,000, if not even more, Shailos and Tshuvos from the Rashba. That's a lot. You understand that until you get to like 200 years ago, I think that's more Shailos and Tshuvos from anyone pre-1800. The first person who printed more Shailos and Tshuvos than that is the Sholem Meshev. I'm not 100% sure, but I'm pretty sure.
There are people who have more Shailos and Tshuvos.
There are, but those are contemporaries of the last 200 years. But in Rishonim, you know, usually the Rishonim, Shalos, and Shuvas are a sefer this big or this big.
Especially before the
Prince. Yeah, I mean, the Rajma, the Rajma, Shalos, and Shuvas could go on forever practically. Okay. Now, finally, wait, and I've been. What?
There's one really big question.
No.
Okay.
What is Shas? Yeah, no. After many weeks, I've been like promising this for like the last month. I said, next week. No, next week. We're finally getting to Rav Moshe de Leon and discovery of the Zohar. Okay. Rav Moshe de Leon, I guess you know, you guys probably not aware of this. De Leon means from Leon. Leon is a part of northwestern Spain.
Like Da Vinci. I heard Da Vinci, like,
yeah,
that's from
Da Vinci. Yeah, that's right. No, but here, de Leon means from Leon. Leon is northwestern Spain. Northwestern Spain. He was primarily a scribe, which, as we sort of commented, but not in a straight fashion, so we'll do it as a straight fashion. We're still a couple hundred years before the printing press. Not that much, about 200 years. But 200 years, not that much historically. 200 years before the printing press, and back in the old days, before printing press, and Taman in Yemen, barely had printing presses until modern times. And as Rabbi Kapach said, have you heard of Kapach? No? He, you can ask Rabbi Shamu about him. He was one of the last Yemenite Talmud Chacham who grew up, was born in Yemen and Taman, and lived there until, let's say, he was 30 or 40. As he says, his father told him that whenever you see a ksav yad, whenever you see a manuscript you've never seen before, the first thing you have to do is make two copies. The reason why I'm saying that over is because that was, Jews are people of the book, as Muslims call us, and that's definitely true. And Safrus, and not only that, today we only think of Safrus as writing Sefer Torah and Mezuzahs, and Tefillin and Sefer Torah and Mezuzahs, Stam, but back in the old days, pre-1500, let's say 1550, I would say, it was a major part of, you know, Jewish economy. You needed Svarim, and the only way to do it was handwritten. And
Memorize everything, or like
that's a different thing. No, they had a dearth of. They did not really have access to printed svarim, or they had limited access. So they were like working in early modern technique. So there's probably more memorization done there than other places. Listen, in Volozhin, in the mid 1700s, the only people who had an entire copy of Shas was Reb Chaim Volozhin's parents. They were business people, lumber. They were in the lumber business. They allowed Shaigas Aryeh, who was the Rav of Volozhin for a number of years. Shaigas Aryeh, we've heard of? Psachim, I hope you've heard of the Shaigas Aryeh. Okay. They allowed the Shaigas Aryeh, because he was the Rav, to borrow two volumes at once. And he gave them a bracha because they allowed him to borrow two volumes at once. They should have two sons who were Talmidei Chachamim. And they did. One was Reb Chaim Volozhin, and the other one was Reb Zalman Volozhin. Reb Zalman Volozhin died young, but Reb Chaim said on him, Reb Chaim said that he was almost as big as the goat. Okay. Anyway, now it's going to be later. The point is back in those days.
They should have let him borrow more.
Yeah, I don't know. you can't be Mechayev the Tzibur. Everyone needed Gemara's back in those days. So if there's only one entire set of Shas in this town, the person had to make sure they knew it. So you're right. So yeah, Yemen was holding an early modern, you know, Metzius facts of life until they came to Israel in the early mid 50s. Anyway, now it's about Yemen.
How expensive like tefillin are nowadays?
Off the topic. Dinner time. Okay. Reb Moshe de Leon was primarily a sofer. He was also a Kabbalist.
Kabbalist,
Mekubal, mystic, Jewish mystic.
Okay. The communists.
Much better. They shouldn't be mentioned in the same sentence. Okay. Say again?
How are you Kabbalistic before the Zohar? What does that mean?
How are you Kabbalistic before the Zohar? Okay, let's go on in order, and then I think you'll understand what I have to say about this. He's most famous for discovery of the Zohar. Reb Moshe Tigliad is most famous for discovery of the Zohar. The Zohar is a midrash on Torah, composed by Reb Shimon Bar Yochai, known as Rashbi. Reb Shimon Bar Yochai. Okay. I'm not sure. It's also part of the Zohar. I don't know. Now, I'm going to be open and honest. I'm not really Mekubal. I don't really know much about Kabbalah. I know anyone who's been to my shiurim knows that. Now, I also say, I usually say this, depending on what I'm talking about, I'll sometimes say, if it's in the right context, that most people who claim to be experts on Kabbalah don't know anything at all.
Like the Kabbalah said to people.
Some people are aware that Isaac Newton, you've heard of Isaac Newton? You've heard of Isaac Newton, just wait, let me say the whole story out, okay? Isaac Newton was fascinated with Zohar. And unlike contemporaries in the Kabbalah centers, he was A, fluent in Hebrew and Aramaic, and B, he was definitely a genius. Now, I still am past 100% confident, if that's possible, but I'm as confident as is possible. There's no way he really understood it. Regardless of his scientific, he's a quantified, clear genius. Einstein said that Newton changed science more than anyone before him or after him ever will be able to. And I don't know enough about science to comment on Einstein's statement, but I think Einstein's statement has value just as it being a statement of Einstein. Okay. Now, the Vilna Gaon, who I'm sure we're aware is no slouch, was also known, it's not quite as well known, but he was also not only an absolute expert in Nigla, in revealed parts of Torah, Shas, he also was a very deep and big expert in Nistar, in Kabbalah.
Do we know how he based his...
Psak is based on Shas.
Right.
Psak is based on Shas. I hope we'll have time to get into that right now, but I'm going to start out with a statement, this part, I'm going to start out with a statement of Vilna Gaon on a Pasuk in Mishlei. Pasuk says in Mishlei, Tepuchi Zav Meskios Kosef. Gold, Peret Chafei Pasuk Yidav. Golden apples, which are silver plated. There's a number of translations. Don't please, you'll tell me later what they do with it. Davor al afanav. A statement which is said in its proper form. Tapuche zav maskios kasev, golden apple that was silver plated. Mishlei chaf hei yed alef. Davur al afnav. Something, a thing, a statement. Davur, which is said al afnav in a proper way. Says the Vilna Gaon. And the Rambam, actually, interestingly, I don't remember, I think it's in the Hakdamah Techelik, but it might be somewhere else. The Rambam says the same thing. This pasuk in Mishlei is illustrating the relationship between Pshat and Sod. This pasuk in Mishlei is illustrating relationship between Pshat and Sod. Now, the Gaon doesn't quite say this, but people commenting on based on the Gaon do say this. The world at large thinks The pshat is like over here, and sod is in a different building, and there's not really that much relation between the two. And the Gaon says that's absolutely false, and it's absolutely not true. So the relationship is what this pasuk is telling us. I have a golden apple and I silver plate it. So a person who doesn't know anything about metals looks at the apple and he sees a silver plate. And he says, you have a silver apple here. Right? A person who's more discerning is able to see there's something under the silver and will be able to penetrate and understand that there's a relationship between the two. And the way you say it is sod is the depth, is the ultimate depth of pshat. And there's a definite relationship between the two. I'll give you an example for this from Chumash, Ki'ilu. The Ramban, almost every single time in his Perush, not every single time, like let's say well over 95%, he explains the Pasuk Derech HaPshat. And after that, he'll go on to sod. And the obvious understanding is there's a relationship between pshat and sod.
Who's this guy?
What, the Ramban. Rashi, whenever Rashi deals with sod, and he definitely might, and probably does, he's kedarko enigmatic about it, and in his own way, an intellectual elitist, that if you don't pick it up, it ain't his fault. Just wait a second. One of the only places the Ramban doesn't do this is in Arias and Forbidden Relations, where the Ramban says there is no real pshat in the forbidden relations, there's no logic to them. And the whole reason they're usur, they're forbidden, is because of sod. But the lesson one can learn from the totalum of Ramban's Perush and Chumash is there usually is relationship, and clear relationship between pshat and sod. And there's a couple of places where there are exceptions to the rules, but those are exceptions and not the rule. So, as I say, just I'm almost done. You got beauty mitzvah. Even though I definitely, I tell you, I honestly don't know that much about Kabbalah, but about pshat, I know about something about pshat, and I know there's a real relationship between the two. Yeah.
Today, so these were before the Zohar was discovered, like the Rashi and Ramban, so they had sowed from like Kabbalah.
Okay, that's a good question. Apparently. The Shomer Amunim, that's a good question. The Shomer Amunim, Rabbi Yosef Irgus, who lived, let's say, between 1670, 1680 to 1750 approximately, Rabbi Yosef Irgus, who is called Shomer Amunim HaKadmon, the early Shomer Amunim, to distinguish from the first Rebbe of Toldos Aaron, who also wrote a sefer called Shomer Amunim. But Yosef Irgus says that the principal concepts of Kabbalah were all in the hands of the Rishonim until the times of the Ramban, but after the Ramban's times, because the Ramban gave over the Kabbalah in such a not unclear, but wait a second.
Enigmatic.
Not enigmatic. They gave it over to Derech Remez. I don't want to. Yeah, I guess I will. You know what? We're on the topic, so even though I'm going to go slightly off the topic, but I hold it's a good illustration. Okay, as I already mentioned, the Vilna Gaon was known to be a Mekubal, to be a Kabbalist. One of the primary rules of Kabbalah is you don't just give it over to anybody. It's only given over to people who you should give it over to. So, it's known. It was also known that all of the Gaon's Talmidim were not Talmidim in Kabbalah. Some were, some weren't. And it was known that Reb Chaim Volozhin was a Talmud of the Vilna Gaon in Kabbalah. But Reb Eliyahu Rugler. Rabbi Eliyahu Rugler, R-O-G-L-E-R. Wanted to learn Kabbalah, so he went to Reb Chaim Volozhin. He lived, let's say, from 1790 to around 1860, approximately. He went to Reb Chaim Volozhin. Reb Chaim Volozhin spoke to him for a while, checked him out, and said, okay, this is a person he's willing to teach the Kabbalah too. He gave him a Seder, how to do it, learn this, learn that, learn the next, do this, do that, do the next. And once a week, we'll discuss the issues of what you're learning. Okay, so Rabbi Elazar, once a week, took Rabbi Elia Rugler into forests outside of Elazar and would talk to him and schmooze with him. And Rabbi Elia Rugler writes that he would tell him stories. He would tell him stories, which ostensibly had nothing to do with the material he was learning. And after 6 months, or maybe it was a year, wait, let me get the whole story out. Rabbi Elia Rugler, using Derech Eretz, asked Rabbi Chaim Volozhin Rishus permission to leave because he didn't feel he was getting anything from it. So Rabbi Chaim said, "Bavakasha, if you want to leave, you can leave." Years later, Rabbi Elia Rugler realized that Rabbi Chaim Volozhin was teaching him Kabbalistic secrets via parable. So, I mean, this is a story, and like I say, a very well quantified story of about not even 200 years ago. One of my old Chavrus's great great grandfather learned by Rabbi Elia Rugler. Okay? So this is a well quantified known story of not that long ago, and I say, and that's what it was like. And this is well post Ari, when things are much more in the open. I can't imagine the brevity that the Ramban employed when he gave over Kabbalah. If Rabbi Chaim Volozhin did it this way, then what the Ramban must have done must have been even much, much more secretive.
Is the Kabbalah the same like the
Ari's? The Talmidei Ari are of the opinion that the Ramban's Kabbalah and the Ari's Kabbalah are the same. Absolutely are. Okay, now.
What do you mean discovered the Zohar?
Okay. The official story. The story he said was he perchanced to go into a cave somewhere in Spain. And there were
Rashi?
No, Rav Moshe de Leon. Rav Moshe de Leon went into a cave in Spain, and there were he's the guy we're talking about, Rav Moshe de Leon. Okay. He discovered the Zohar, and there were like big barrels, or not barrels, that were like a pot, big pottery, similar to Dead Sea Scrolls. And he looked into, opened them up and looked into them, and he saw that found the Zohar.
It was like giant manuscript.
I'm not sure. That much historical fact is not brought down.
How do we know it's written by?
How do we know it's written by Rashi? How do we know? So if you think, I mean, it's like this. No. Okay. That's what I think. Say again? In the 1270s, 1280s. Okay, now. I don't know if anyone here is aware of this, but because of academics axiomatically assume that Rav Moshe de Leon forged the Zohar. That's what they say. No need for sound effects, Feldman. Academics axiomatically assume that Rav Moshe de Leon forged the Zohar. And it's a little late, but I still want to go through their train of thought in order to because I just feel it's a very important issue. I think it's a very important issue. Okay. Just wait a second. Please don't interrupt now. Okay. There's no question, historically speaking, in southern France at this time, there was a lot of tumult and storminess about church dogma, about Catholic church dogma. And there were a lot of people who were deeply convinced that the church was completely off, misunderstanding the false testament and giving all the wrong instructions out to people. And as and there's no question, and I'm not going to doubt, that there was mysticism going on in these areas, outside of the Jewish settings. There's no question about that. The proposition, though, that you could throw out Torah or accept the Torah and replace it with new Torah is just, it's to call that idea foreign and against Torah is just such an extreme projection of what I call Western mindset on Torah and who Talmidei Chachamim were. It's a total non-starter. I mean, we're not going to doubt, and I spoke about the Rambam at length. No one doubts the Rambam was a big philosopher. No one doubts that. But as the Ramban points out in his famous long Igeris, which we went through a lot of, or a nice amount of, the Rambam, when it comes to Shas, he paskins everything. Even the Pesachim, which Shas ostensibly says are because of Shadim, the Rambam paskins it anyway. Okay, he leaves the Shadim part out. That's true. No, but you're missing the point is when it comes to Psak Halacha and what to do, the Rambam paskins Kal Kachamura, he paskins through everything in Shas, every din in Shas he brings. He doesn't forget anything, and as the Ramban says, he's even Machmer sometimes more than he should have been. Ki'ilu, that's Ramban's opinion, and in Psak. So, it's an untouchable, it's nothing to do, you can have mindset as much as you want, but when it comes in terms of Guf HaTorah, it's unchangeable. And no one across the Jewish spectrum thinks anything different. Now, I'm to say that I'm hesitant isn't strong enough. I am 100% sure that it is not possible for any academic, with maybe exception of one person, maybe, Shaul Lieberman, but he wasn't a Mekubal, so I'm sure he didn't understand it. But he's practically the only academic who really knew how to learn. And I can tell you personally, I spent 3 months on a sugya called Kol Kavula Kamechzal Mechzadami. You got the Testament Beja himself? Yeah. No? Yeah? You're getting there. Okay. I spent 3 months on it. Not on Testament Beja himself, I'm on the sugya Kavua. It's a hard sugya. And when I learned Isser Veheter, which is what people learn for Smicha, I learned with Rabbi Yaakov Asher Feldman once a week. Yeah, I don't know if you might be related. You never know, but Feldman's a common name. Rabbi Yaakov Asher Feldman knows Isser V'Heter so well, and I'm almost not exaggerating here. He was spewing Chidushei Torah at us as he was falling asleep. After we had learned it for 2 or 3 weeks, and normally there was nowhere in Isser V'Heter that means, the body of Yardaya, of Mulicha Basim Chalb, Taruvus Shchita, etc. There was not one place where he ever hesitated for more than, he did nothing. Everything, nothing, on the spot. Bam, on the spot, on the spot. There was only one exception to all of that. That was Kavua. We tried to say something on Kavua, he disproved us. He tried to say something, we disproved it. It was the only time we ever did it to him. The only time in the entire history of the Heter where he wasn't able to say something accurate on the spot was Kavua. After I spent a very long time on it, I feel that I got a solid understanding of the sugya. Now, I can tell you, I'm 100% sure that Nistar, the Kabbalah, is at least as hard as Kavua. I don't know if every single part of it, but I'm sure a lot of it is. So, with that in mind, I'm 100% sure, I don't care how brilliant the academic is, he doesn't have the necessary introductions, necessary training. It's not possible for him to really understand it. Now, there's a different. For the records, the Radal, who's sort of contemporary with David Luria, he died around 1840. From David Luria, well known, brilliant Talmud Chacham and Mekubal of Lithuania.
Related to the
Arizal? I'm not sure. I would assume he was related to the Marashal, to the Amshul Shlomo.
What was his name?
Luria also, yeah. People believe that the Maharshal and the Ari were like fourth cousins or something like that. Okay. The Reb David Luria points out that Ramosha de Leon's own personal, he wrote two or three known chiburim, known works on Kabbalah. And the Radal points out that they don't really work with the Zohar.
So
Hare to say that Ramosha de Leon forged the Zohar is like a little strange if he himself held differently in Kabbalah. Now again, I don't really know enough about Kabbalah to say more than this, but I am sure that Rav David Luria is a much bigger expert in Kabbalah than Gershon Shalom. Now that's beyond obvious. Now just to say again? Okay. Contrary to common belief, or at least to academic belief, see, academics superimpose their own mindset on Talmidei Chachamim. They have a belief that Talmidei Chachamim are primitive, not critical thinkers, not analytical thinkers. It's just not really true. It's not true. I mean, you want to say that every single Talmud Chacham does not have the same level of critical thought. You're right. They're not all the same. But the Zohar and Kabbalah has been, has been given over to intense analysis for a long time. These problems have been known for a very long time. And it's absolutely accepted, certainly in the Hasidic world, but in the literature world also, as authentic, and it's beyond the scope of our ability of who we are to say that the Zohar is not authentic. But just I do have one more thing to say. I could say two. Should I say one or two? I'll give you a choice. Okay, I'll say the more interesting one. I'll give you the more interesting one, then tell you the less. Then tell you the less interesting one. Okay, this I feel I'm momish. I have to say this. Now, the academic opinion is that the Zohar. Now they have a problem. The Zohar is written in perfect second century Palestinian Aramaic dialect. Now, obviously, if the Rashbi wrote it, then that works. Now, of course. It's unclear if Ramosha de Leon was brilliant enough to realize that. I mean, we understand Ki'ilu, if the Rambam would have been the person, then we would understand the Rambam probably could have figured, I'm not even sure if that's true, but probably could have figured that out. So what do they say? So they say, Ramosha de Leon wrote it in 2nd century Palestinian Aramaic in order to convince people that it's really the Rashbis. Okay, now I'll tell you, yeah, okay.
There are other possibilities, though. That's not the only possibility. It could have been written, A, by somebody else in that imitation, or
yeah, but
B,
okay.
Written by somebody in that century.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, but you know what? The problem is no one, even the most cynical academics, is going to tell you that if it was written in the second century and the second century Tana, there's no reason to doubt it was written by the Rashbi. Like, that makes no sense at all. Wait a second. If you want to know, I always say historical parallelisms are important. And one of the historical parallels to this is from the Dreyfus Affair.
Really?
Yes, from the Dreyfus Affair. Yeah, it's after 7, so it has to be good, right? The Dreyfus Affair, is anyone, are we basically familiar with the Dreyfus Affair?
Yeah.
Okay, good, basically, okay. The real villain's name was?
What?
No, the villain's name
was
Esterhazy.
What?
Esterhazy was the name of the real villain. What? Yeah, okay. Esterhazy was the one who was the real spy hired by the Germans. He wasn't hired, okay, it's a little more complicated than that. He was spying for the Germans on the French. He was French, but he was spying for the Germans. Okay? Now, Esterhazy had a note that he wrote to the German military attaché about, you want information about three different things. Okay, I will try to get it for you. Okay, they got the note out of a garbage can, reassembled the note. Looked at the note, okay, whose is this? There's a Jew on the general staff, his name is Dreyfus. There's a Jew, he must be the traitor, and they convicted Dreyfus. Eventually, that note, which I don't remember its proper name in Dreyfus history right now, I forgot to look that up also, that note was printed in French newspapers in the middle of the Dreyfus affair. Okay, Esterhazy's banker says, what's the question? I've seen this handwriting hundreds of times. It's Esterhazy. Okay, so what did the anti-Semite say?
His banker?
His banker. Oh, Dreyfus knew Esterhazy's handwriting and forged it in Esterhazy's handwriting to incriminate Esterhazy. God, if you want to know where that type of argument lies, you have it for the historical record.